Carnegie, the father of the U.S. steel industry, chose for his own tombstone. Here lies a man who knew how to bring into his service men better than he was himself. But of course, every one of these men was quote-unquote better, because Carnegie looked for his strength and put it to work. Each of these steel executives was a better man in one specific area and for one specific job. Carnegie, however, was the effective executive among them. Another story about General Robert E. Lee illustrates the meaning of making strength productive. One of his generals, the story goes, had disregarded orders and had thereby completely upset Lee's plans, and not for the first time either. Lee, who normally controlled his temper, blew up in a towering rage. When he'd simmered down, one of his aides asked respectfully, "Why don't you relieve him of his command?" Lee, it said, turned around in complete amazement, looked at the aide and said, "What an absurd question. He performs." Effective executives know that their subordinates are paid to perform and not to please their superiors. They know that it doesn't matter how many tantrums a prima donna throws as long as she brings in the customers. The opera manager is paid, after all, for putting up with the prima donna's tantrums if that's her way to achieve excellence in performance. It doesn't matter whether a first-rate teacher or a brilliant scholar is pleasant to the dean or amiable in the faculty meeting. The dean's paid for enabling the first-rate teacher or the first-rate scholar to do his work effectively. And if this involves unpleasantness in the administrative routine, it's still cheap at the price. Effective executives never ask, "How does he get along with me?" Their question is, "What does he contribute?" Their question's never, "What can a man not do?" Their question's always, "What can he do uncommonly well?" In staffing, they look for excellence in one major area and not for performance that gets by all around. To look for one area of strength and to attempt to put it to work is dictated by the nature of man. In fact, all the talk of the whole man or the mature personality hides a profound contempt for man's most specific gift, his ability to put all his resources behind one activity, one field of endeavor, one area of accomplishment. It's, in other words, contempt for excellence. Human excellence can only be achieved in one area, or at the most, in very few. People with many interests do exist, and this is usually what we mean when we talk of a universal genius. People with outstanding accomplishments in many areas are unknown. Even Leonardo performed only in the area of design, despite his manifold interests. If Goethe's poetry had been lost and all that were known of his works were his dabblings in optics and philosophy, he wouldn't even rate a footnote in the most learned encyclopedia. What's true for the giants holds doubly for the rest of us. Unless, therefore, an executive looks for strength and works at making strength productive, he'll only get the impact of what a man can't do, of his lacks, his weaknesses, his impediments to performance and effectiveness. To staff from what there is not and to focus on weakness is wasteful, a misuse, if not abuse, of the human resource. To focus on strength is to make demands for performance. The man who doesn't first ask, "What can a man do?" is bound to accept far less than the associate can really contribute. He excuses the associate's non-performance in advance. He's destructive but not critical, let alone realistic. The really demanding boss, and one way or another all makers of men are demanding bosses, always starts out with what a man should be able to do well and then demands that he really do it. To try to build against weakness frustrates the purpose of organization. Organization is the specific instrument to make human strengths redound to performance, while human weakness is neutralized and largely rendered harmless. The very strong neither need nor desire organization. They're much better off working on their own. The rest of us, however, the great majority, don't have so much strength that by itself it would become effective despite our limitations. One cannot hire a hand, the whole man always comes with it, says a proverb of the human relations people. Similarly, one can't by oneself be only strong. The weaknesses are always with us. But we can so structure an organization that the weaknesses become a personal blemish outside of, or at least beside, the work and accomplishment. We can so structure as to make the strength relevant. A good tax accountant in private practice might be greatly hampered by his inability to get along with people, but in an organization, such a man can be set up in an office of his own and shielded from direct contact with other people. In an organization, one can make his strength effective and his weakness irrelevant. The small businessman who's good at finance but poor at production or marketing is likely to get into trouble. In a somewhat larger business, one can easily make productive a man who has true strength in finance alone. Effective executives aren't blind to weakness. The executive who understands that it's his job to enable John Jones to do the tax accounting has no illusions about Jones's ability to get along with people. He'd never appoint Jones a manager. But there are others who get along with people. First-rate tax accountants are a good deal rarer. Therefore, what this man and many others like him can do is pertinent in an organization. What he can't do is a limitation and nothing else. All this is obvious, one might say. Why then isn't it done all the time? Why are executives rare who make strength productive, especially the strength of their associates? Why did even a Lincoln staff from weakness 3 times before he picked strength? The main reason is that the immediate task of the executive isn't to place a man, it's to fill a job. The tendency is therefore to start out with the job as being a part of the order of nature. Then one looks for a man to fill the job. It's only too easy to be misled this way into looking for the least misfit, the one man who leaves least to be desired, and this is invariably the mediocrity. The widely advertised cure for this is to structure jobs to fit the personalities available, but this cure is worse than the disease, except perhaps in a very small and simple organization. Jobs have to be objective, that is, determined by task rather than by personality. One reason for this is that every change in the definition, structure, and position of a job within an organization sets off a chain reaction of changes throughout the entire institution. Jobs in an organization are interdependent and interlocked. One can't change everybody's work and responsibility just because one has to replace a single man in a single job. To structure a job to a person is almost certain to result in the end in greater discrepancy between the demands of the job and the available talent. It results in a dozen people being uprooted and pushed around in order to accommodate one. This is by no means true only of bureaucratic organizations, such as a government agency or a large business corporation. Somebody has to teach the introductory course in biochemistry in the university. It had better be a good man. Such a man will be a specialist, yet the course has to be general and has to include the foundation materials of the discipline, regardless of the interests and inclinations of the teacher. What is to be taught is determined by what the students need, that is, by an objective requirement, which the individual instructor has to accept. When the orchestra conductor has to fill the job of first cellist, he won't even consider a poor cellist who is a first-rate oboe player, even though the oboist might be a greater musician than any of the available cellists. The conductor won't rewrite the score to accommodate a man. The opera manager who knows that he's being paid for putting up with the tantrums of the prima donna still expects her to sing Tosca when the playbill announces Tosca. But there's a subtler reason for insistence on impersonal, objective jobs. It's the only way to provide the organization with the human diversity it needs. It's the only way to tolerate, indeed to encourage, differences in temperament and personality in an organization. To tolerate diversity, relationships must be task-focused rather than personality-focused. Achievement must be measured against objective criteria of contribution and performance. This is possible, however, only if jobs are defined and structured impersonally. Otherwise, the accent will be on who is right rather than on what is right. In no time, personnel decisions will be made on, do I like this fellow, or will he be acceptable, rather than by asking, is he the man most likely to do an outstanding job? Structuring jobs to fit personality is almost certain to lead to favoritism and conformity, and no organization can afford either. It needs equity and impersonal fairness in its personnel decisions, or else it'll either lose its good people or destroy their incentive. And it needs diversity, or else it'll lack the ability to change and the ability for dissent, which, as Chapter 7 will discuss, the right decision demands. One implication is that the men who build first-class executive teams aren't usually close to their immediate colleagues and subordinates. Picking people for what they can do rather than on personal likes or dislikes, they seek performance, not conformance. To ensure this outcome, they keep a distance between themselves and their close colleagues. Lincoln, it has often been remarked, only became an effective chief executive after he had changed from close personal relations, for example, with Stanton, his Secretary of War, to aloofness and distance. Franklin D. Roosevelt had no friend in the cabinet. Not even Henry Morgenthau, his Secretary of the Treasury, and a close friend on all non-governmental matters. General Marshall and Alfred P. Sloan were similarly remote. These were all warm men in need of close human relationships, endowed with the gift of making and keeping friends. They knew, however, that their friendships had to be off the job. They knew that whether they liked the man or approved of him was irrelevant, if not a distraction, and by staying aloof, they were able to build teams of great diversity, but also of strength. Of course, there are always exceptions where the job should be fitted to the man. Even Sloan, despite his insistence on impersonal structure, consciously designed the early engineering organization of General Motors around a man, Charles F. Kettering, the great inventor. Roosevelt broke every rule in the book to enable the dying Harry Hopkins to make his unique contribution. But these exceptions should be rare, and they should only be made for a man who has proven exceptional capacity to do the unusual with excellence. How then do effective executives staff for strength without stumbling into the opposite trap of building jobs to suit personality? By and large, they follow four rules. First, they don't start out with the assumption that jobs are created by nature or by God. They know that they've been designed by highly fallible men, and they're therefore forever on guard against the impossible job, the job that simply isn't for normal human beings. Such jobs are common. They usually look exceedingly logical on paper, but they can't be filled. One man of proven performance capacity after the other is tried, and none does well. 6 months or a year later, the job has defeated them. Almost always such a job was first created to accommodate an unusual man and tailored to his idiosyncrasies. It usually calls for a mixture of temperaments that's rarely found in one person. Individuals can acquire very divergent kinds of knowledge and highly disparate skills, but they can't change their temperaments. A job that calls for disparate temperaments becomes an undoable job, a man-killer. The rule is simple. Any job that's defeated two or three men in succession, even though each had performed well in his previous assignments, must be assumed unfit for human beings. It must be redesigned. Every text on marketing concludes, for instance, that sales management belongs together with advertising and promotion and under the same marketing executive. The experience of large national manufacturers of branded and mass-marketed consumer goods has been, however, that this overall marketing job is impossible. Such a business needs both high effectiveness in field selling, that is, in moving goods, and high effectiveness in advertising and promotion, that is, in moving people. These appeal to different personalities, which rarely can be found in one man. The presidency of a large university in the United States is also such an impossible job. At least our experience has been that only a small minority of the appointments to this position work out, even though the men chosen have almost always a long history of substantial achievement in earlier assignments. Another example is probably the international vice president of today's large multinational business. As soon as production and sales outside the parent company's territory become significant, as soon as they exceed one-fifth of the total or so, putting everything that's not parent company in one organizational component creates an impossible, a man-killing job. The work either has to be reorganized by worldwide product groups, as Philips in Holland has done, for instance, or according to common social and economic characteristics of major markets. For instance, it might be split into three jobs, one managing the business in the industrialized countries, the United States, Canada, Western Europe, Japan, one the business in the developing countries, most of Latin America, Australia, India, the Near East, one the business in the remaining underdeveloped ones. Several major chemical companies are going this route. The ambassador of a major power today is in a similar predicament. His embassy has become so huge, unwieldy, and diffuse in its activities that a man who can administer it has no time for, and almost certainly no interest in, his first job, getting to know the country of his assignment, its government, its policies, its people, and to get known and trusted by them. And despite Mr. McNamara's lion-taming act at the Pentagon, I'm not yet convinced that the job of Secretary of Defense of the United States is really possible, though I admit I can't conceive of an alternative. The effective executive, therefore, first makes sure that the job is well designed, and if experience tells him otherwise, he doesn't hunt for genius to do the impossible. He redesigns the job. He knows that the test of organization isn't genius. It's its capacity to make common people achieve uncommon performance. Two. The second rule for staffing from strength is to make each job demanding and big. It should have challenge to bring out whatever strength a man may have. It should have scope so that any strength that's relevant to the task can produce significant results. This, however, isn't the policy of most large organizations. They tend to make the job small, which would make sense only if people were designed and machined for specific performance at a given moment. Yet, not only do we have to fill jobs with people as they come, the demands of any job above the simplest are also bound to change, and often abruptly. The perfect fit then rapidly becomes the misfit. Only if the job is big and demanding to begin with will it enable a man to rise to the new demands of a changed situation. This rule applies to the job of the beginning knowledge worker in particular. Whatever his strength, it should have a chance to find full play. In his first job, the standards are set by which a knowledge worker will guide himself the rest of his career and by which he'll measure himself and his contribution. Till he enters the first adult job, the knowledge worker never has had a chance to perform. All one can do in school is to show promise. Performance is possible only in real work, whether in a research lab, in a teaching job, in a business, or in a government agency. Both for the beginner in knowledge work and for the rest of the organization, his colleagues and his superiors, the most important thing to find out is what he can really do. It's equally important for him to find out as early as possible whether he's indeed in the right place or even in the right kind of work. There are fairly reliable tests for the aptitudes and skills needed in manual work. One can test in advance whether a man's likely to do well as a carpenter or as a machinist. There's no such test appropriate to knowledge work. What's needed in knowledge work isn't this or that particular skill, but a configuration, and this will be revealed only by the test of performance. A carpenter's or a machinist's job is defined by the craft and varies little from one shop to another. But for the ability of a knowledge worker to contribute in an organization, the values and the goals of the organization are at least as important as his own professional knowledge and skills. A young man who has the right strength for one organization may be a total misfit in another, which from the outside looks just the same. The first job should therefore enable him to test both himself and the organization. This not only holds for different kinds of organization, such as government agencies, universities, or businesses, it's equally true between organizations of the same kind. I have yet to see two large businesses which have the same values and stress the same contributions. That a man who was happy and productive as a member of the faculty of one university may find himself lost, unhappy, and frustrated when he moves to another one, every academic administrator has learned, and no matter how much the Civil Service Commission tries to make all government departments observe the same rules and use the same yardsticks, government agencies, once they've been in existence for a few years, have a distinct personality. Each requires a different behavior from its staff members, especially from those in the professional grades, to be effective and to make a contribution. It's easy to move while young, at least in the Western countries where mobility is accepted. Once one has been in an organization for 10 years or more, however, it becomes increasingly difficult, especially for those who have not been too effective. The young knowledge worker should therefore ask himself early, am I in the right work and in the right place for my strengths to tell? But he can't ask this question, let alone answer it, if the beginning job is too small, too easy, and designed to offset his lack of experience rather than to bring out what he can do. Every survey of young knowledge workers, physicians in the Army Medical Corps, chemists in the research lab, accountants or engineers in the plant, nurses in the hospital, produces the same results. The ones who are enthusiastic and who in turn have results to show for their work are the ones whose abilities are being challenged and used. Those that are deeply frustrated all say, in one way or another, my abilities are not being put to use. The young knowledge worker whose job is too small to challenge and test his abilities either leaves or declines rapidly into premature middle age, soured, cynical, unproductive. Executives everywhere complain that many young men with fire in their bellies turn so soon into burned-out sticks. They have only themselves to blame. They quenched the fire by making the young man's job too small. 3. Effective executives know that they have to start with what a man can do rather than with what a job requires. This, however, means that they do their thinking about people long before the decision on filling a job has to be made and independently of it. This is the reason for the wide adoption of appraisal procedures today, in which people, especially those in knowledge work, are regularly judged. The purpose is to arrive at an appraisal of a man before one has to decide whether he's the right person to fill a bigger position. However, while almost every large organization has an appraisal procedure, few of them actually use it. Again and again, the same executives who say that of course they appraise every one of their subordinates at least once a year report that to the best of their knowledge, they themselves have never been appraised by their own superiors. Again and again, the appraisal forms remain in the files and nobody looks at them when a personnel decision has to be made. Everybody dismisses them as so much useless paper. Above all, almost without exception, the appraisal interview in which the superior is to sit down with the subordinate and discuss the findings never takes place. Yet the appraisal interview is the crux of the whole system. One clue to what's wrong was contained in an advertisement of a new book on management which talked of the appraisal interview as the most distasteful job of the superior. Appraisals as they're now being used in the great majority of organizations were designed originally by the clinical and abnormal psychologists for their own purposes. The clinician is a therapist trained to heal the sick. He's legitimately concerned with what's wrong rather than what's right with the patient. He assumes as a matter of course that nobody comes to him unless he's in trouble. The clinical psychologist or the abnormal psychologist, therefore, very properly looks upon appraisals as a process of diagnosing the weaknesses of a man. I became aware of this in my first exposure to Japanese management. Running a seminar on executive development, I found to my surprise that none of the Japanese participants, all top men in large organizations, used appraisals. When I asked why not, one of them said, "Your appraisals are concerned only with bringing out a man's faults and weaknesses. Since we can neither fire a man nor deny him advancement and promotion, this is of no interest to us. On the contrary, the less we know about his weaknesses, the better. What we do need to know are the strengths of a man and what he can do. Your appraisals are not even interested in this." Western psychologists, especially those that design appraisals, might well disagree, but this is how every executive, whether Japanese, American, or German, sees the traditional appraisals. Altogether, the West might well ponder the lessons of the Japanese achievement. As everyone's heard, there's lifetime employment in Japan. Once a man's on the payroll, he'll advance in his category as a worker, a white-collar employee, or a professional, an executive employee, according to his age and length of service, with his salary doubling about once every 15 years. He can't leave, neither can he be fired. Only at the top and after age 45 is there differentiation, with a very small group selected by ability and merit into the senior executive positions. How can such a system be squared with the tremendous capacity for results and achievement Japan has shown? The answer is that their system forces the Japanese to play down weaknesses. Precisely because they can't move people, Japanese executives always look for the man in the group who can do the job. They always look for strength. I don't recommend the Japanese system. It's far from ideal. A very small number of people who have proven their capacity to perform do, in effect, everything of any importance whatever. The rest are carried by the organization. But if we in the West expect to get the benefit of the much greater mobility that both individual and organization enjoy in our tradition, we'd better adopt the Japanese custom of looking for strength and using strength. For a superior to focus on weakness, as our appraisals require him to do, destroys the integrity of his relationship with his subordinates. The many executives who in effect sabotage the appraisals their policy manuals impose on them follow sound instinct. It's also perfectly understandable that they consider an appraisal interview that focuses on a search for faults, defects, and weaknesses distasteful. To discuss a man's defects when he comes in as a patient seeking help is the responsibility of the healer, but as has been known since Hippocrates, this presupposes a professional and privileged relationship between healer and patient, which is incompatible with the authority relationship between superior and subordinate. It's a relationship that makes continued working together almost impossible. That so few executives use the official appraisal is thus hardly surprising. It's the wrong tool, in the wrong situation, for the wrong purpose. Appraisals, and the philosophy behind them, are also far too much concerned with potential. But experienced people have learned that one can't appraise potential for any length of time, ahead, or for anything very different from what a man is already doing. Potential is simply another word for promise, and even if the promise is there, it may well go unfulfilled, while people who haven't shown such promise, if only because they may not have had the opportunity, actually produce the performance. All one can measure is performance, and all one should measure is performance. This is another reason for making jobs big and challenging. It's also a reason for thinking through the contribution a man should make to the results and the performance of his organization. For one can measure the performance of a man only against specific performance expectations. Still, one needs some form of appraisal procedure, or else one makes the personnel evaluation at the wrong time, that is, when a job has to be filled. Effective executives, therefore, usually work out their own radically different form. It starts out with a statement of the major contributions expected from a man in his past and present positions, and a record of his performance against these goals. Then it asks four questions. A. What has he or she done well? B. What, therefore, is he likely to be able to do well? C. What does he have to learn or to acquire to be able to get the full benefit from his strength? D. If I had a son or daughter, would I be willing to have him or her work under this person? 1. If yes, why? 2. If no, why? This appraisal actually takes a much more critical look at a man than the usual procedure does, but it focuses on strengths. It begins with what a man can do. Weaknesses are seen as limitations to the full use of his strengths and to his own achievement, effectiveness, and accomplishment. The last question, too, is the only one which is not primarily concerned with strengths. Subordinates, especially bright, young, and ambitious ones, tend to mold themselves after a forceful boss. There's therefore nothing more corrupting and more destructive in an organization than a forceful but basically corrupt executive. Such a man might well operate effectively on his own. Even within an organization, he might be tolerable if denied all power over others. But in a position of power within an organization, he destroys. Here, therefore, is the one area in which weakness in itself is of importance and relevance. By themselves, character and integrity don't accomplish anything, but their absence faults everything else. Here, therefore, is the one area where weakness is a disqualification by itself rather than a limitation on performance capacity and strength. 4. The effective executive knows that to get strength, one has to put up with weaknesses. There have been few great commanders in history who weren't self-centered, conceited, and full of admiration for what they saw in the mirror. The reverse doesn't, of course, hold. There have been plenty of generals who were convinced of their own greatness, but who haven't gone down in history as great commanders. Similarly, the politician who doesn't with every fiber in his body want to be president or prime minister isn't likely to be remembered as a statesman. He'll at best be a useful, perhaps a highly useful, journeyman. To be more requires a man who's conceited enough to believe that the world, or at least the nation, really needs him and depends on his getting into power. Again, the reverse doesn't hold true. If the need is for the ability to command in a perilous situation, one has to accept a Disraeli or a Franklin D. Roosevelt and not worry too much about their lack of humility. There are indeed no great men to their ballots, but the laugh is on the ballot. He sees inevitably all the traits that aren't relevant, all the traits that have nothing to do with the specific task for which a man has been called on the stage of history. The effective executive will therefore ask, does this man have strength in one major area, and is this strength relevant to the task? If he achieves excellence in this one area, will it make a significant difference? And if the answer's yes, he'll go ahead and appoint the man. Effective executives rarely suffer from the delusion that two mediocrities achieve as much as one good man. They've learned that, as a rule, two mediocrities achieve even less than one mediocrity. They just get in each other's way. They accept that abilities must be specific to produce performance. They never talk of a good man, but always about a man who is good for some one task, but in this one task, they search for strength and staff for excellence. This also implies that they focus on opportunity in their staffing, not on problems. They are above all intolerant of the argument, I can't spare this man, I'd be in trouble without him. They've learned that there are only three explanations for an indispensable man. He's actually incompetent and can only survive if carefully shielded from demands. His strength is misused to bolster a weak superior who can't stand on his own 2 feet, or his strength is misused to delay tackling a serious problem, if not to conceal its existence. In every one of these situations, the indispensable man should be moved anyhow, and soon. Otherwise, one only destroys whatever strengths he may have. The chief executive who was mentioned in Chapter 3 for his unconventional methods of making effective the manager development policies of a large retail chain also decided to move automatically anyone whose boss described him as indispensable. "This either means," he said, "that I have a weak superior or a weak subordinate or both. Whichever of these, the sooner we find out, the better." Altogether, it must be an unbreakable rule to promote the man who by the test of performance is best qualified for the job to be filled. All arguments to the contrary, he is indispensable, he won't be acceptable to the people there, he's too young, or we never put a man in there without field experience, should be given short thrift. Not only does the job deserve the best man, the man of proven performance has earned the opportunity. Staffing the opportunities instead of the problems not only creates the most effective organization, it also creates enthusiasm and dedication. Conversely, it's the duty of the executive to remove ruthlessly anyone, and especially any manager, who consistently fails to perform with high distinction. To let such a man stay on corrupts the others. It's grossly unfair to the whole organization. It's grossly unfair to his subordinates who are deprived by their superiors' inadequacy of opportunities for achievement and recognition. Above all, it's senseless cruelty to the man himself. He knows that he's inadequate whether he admits it to himself or not. Indeed, I've never seen anyone in a job for which he was inadequate who wasn't slowly being destroyed by the pressure and the strains and who didn't secretly pray for deliverance. That neither the Japanese lifetime employment nor the various civil service systems of the West consider proven incompetence ground for removal is a serious weakness and an unnecessary one. General Marshall, during World War II, insisted that a general officer be immediately relieved if found less than outstanding. To keep him in command, he reasoned, was incompatible with the responsibility the army and the nation owed the men under an officer's command. Marshall flatly refused to listen to the argument, "But we have no replacement. All that matters," he pointed out, "is that you know that this man is not equal to the task. Where his replacement comes from is the next question." But Marshall also insisted that to relieve a man from command was less a judgment on the man than on the commander who had appointed him. "The only thing we know is that this spot was the wrong one for the man," he argued. "This does not mean that he is not the ideal man for some other job. Appointing him was my mistake. Now it's up to me to find what he can do." Altogether, General Marshall offers a good example of how one makes strength productive. When he first reached a position of influence in the mid-30s, there was no general officer in the U.S. Army still young enough for active duty. Marshall himself only beat the deadline by 4 months. His 60th birthday, when he would have been too old to take office as chief of staff, was on December 31, 1939. He was appointed on September 1st of the same year. The future generals of World War II were still junior officers with few hopes for promotion when Marshall began to select and train them. Eisenhower was one of the older ones, and even he, in the mid-30s, was only a major, yet by 1942, Marshall had developed the largest and clearly the ablest group of general officers in American history. There were almost no failures in it, and not many second-raters. This, one of the greatest educational feats in military history, was done by a man who lacked all the normal trappings of leadership, such as the personal magnetism or the towering self-confidence of a Montgomery, a de Gaulle, or a MacArthur. What Marshall had were principles. "What can this man do?" was his constant question, and if a man could do something, his lacks became secondary. Marshall, for instance, again and again came to George Patton's rescue and made sure that this ambitious, vain, but powerful wartime commander wouldn't be penalized for the absence of the qualities that made a good staff officer and a successful career soldier in peacetime. Yet Marshall himself personally loathed the dashing beau sabreur of Patton's type. Marshall was only concerned with weaknesses when they limited the full development of a man's strength. These he tried to overcome through work and career opportunities. The young Major Eisenhower, for instance, was quite deliberately put by Marshall into war planning in the mid-30s to help him acquire the systematic strategic understanding which he apparently lacked. Eisenhower didn't himself become a strategist as a result, but he acquired respect for strategy and an understanding of its importance and thereby removed a serious limitation on his great strength as a team builder and tactical planner. Marshall always appointed the best qualified man, no matter how badly he was needed where he was. "We owe this move to the job. We owe it to the man, and we owe it to the troops," was his reply when someone, usually someone high up, pleaded with him not to pull out an indispensable man. He made but one exception. When President Roosevelt pleaded that Marshall was indispensable to him, Marshall stayed in Washington, yielded supreme command in Europe to Eisenhower, and thus gave up his life's dream. Finally, Marshall knew, and everyone can learn it from him, that every people decision is a gamble. By basing it on what a man can do, it becomes at least a rational gamble. A superior has responsibility for the work of others. He also has power over the careers of others. Making strengths productive is therefore much more than an essential of effectiveness. It's a moral imperative, a responsibility of authority and position. To focus on weakness isn't only foolish, it's irresponsible. A superior owes it to his organization to make the strength of every one of his subordinates as productive as it can be. But even more does he owe it to the human beings over whom he exercises authority to help them get the most out of whatever strength they may have. Organization must serve the individual to achieve through his strengths and regardless of his limitations and weaknesses. This is becoming increasingly important, indeed critical. Only a short generation ago, the number of knowledge jobs and the range of knowledge employments were small. To be a civil servant in the German or in the Scandinavian governments, one had to have a law degree. A mathematician need not apply. Conversely, a young man wanting to make a living by putting his knowledge to work had only three or four choices of fields and employment. Today there's a bewildering variety of knowledge work and an equally bewildering variety of employment choices for men of knowledge. Around 1900, the only knowledge fields for all practical purposes were still the traditional professions, the law, medicine, teaching, and preaching. There are now literally hundreds of different disciplines. Moreover, practically every knowledge area is being put to productive use in and by organization, especially, of course, by business and government. On the one hand, therefore, one can today try to find the knowledge area and the kind of work to which one's abilities are best fitted. One need no longer, as one had to do even in the recent past, fit oneself to the available knowledge areas and employments. On the other hand, it's increasingly difficult for a young man to make his choice. He doesn't have enough information, either about himself or about the opportunities. This makes it much more important for the individual that he be directed toward making his strengths productive. It also makes it important for the organization that its executives focus on strengths and work on making strengths productive in their own group and with their own subordinates. Staffing for strength is thus essential to the executive's own effectiveness and to that of his organization, but equally to individual and society in a world of knowledge work. How do I manage my boss? Above all, the effective executive tries to make fully productive the strengths of his own superior. I have yet to find a manager, whether in business, in government, or in any other institution, who didn't say, "I have no great trouble managing my subordinates, but how do I manage my boss?" It's actually remarkably easy, but only effective executives know that. The secret is that effective executives make the strengths of the boss productive. This should be elementary prudence. Contrary to popular legend, subordinates don't, as a rule, rise to position and prominence over the prostrate bodies of incompetent bosses. If their boss isn't promoted, they'll tend to be bottled up behind him, and if their boss is relieved for incompetence or failure, the successor is rarely the bright young man next in line. He usually is brought in from the outside and brings with him his own bright young men. Conversely, there's nothing quite as conducive to success as a successful and rapidly promoted superior. But way beyond prudence, making the strength of the boss productive is a key to the subordinate's own effectiveness. It enables him to focus his own contribution in such a way that it finds receptivity upstairs and will be put to use. It enables him to achieve and accomplish the things he himself believes in. One doesn't make the strengths of the boss productive by toadying to him. One does it by starting out with what's right and presenting it in a form which is accessible to the superior. The effective executive accepts that the boss is human, something that intelligent young subordinates often find hard. Because the superior is human, he has his strengths, but he also has limitations. To build on his strengths, that is, to enable him to do what he can do, will make him effective and will make the subordinate effective. To try to build on his weaknesses will be as frustrating and as stultifying as to try to build on the weaknesses of a subordinate. The effective executive, therefore, asks, what can my boss do really well? What has he done really well? What does he need to know to use his strength? What does he need to get from me to perform? He doesn't worry too much over what the boss can't do. Subordinates typically want to reform the boss. The able senior civil servant is inclined to see himself as the tutor to the newly appointed political head of his agency. He tries to get his boss to overcome his limitations. The effective ones ask instead, what can the new boss do? And if the answer is he's good at relationships with Congress, the White House, and the public, then the civil servant works at making it possible for his minister to use these abilities. For the best administration and the best policy decisions are futile unless there's also political skill in representing them. Once the politician knows that the civil servant supports him, he'll soon enough listen to him on policy and on administration. The effective executive also knows that the boss, being human, has his own ways of being effective. He looks for these ways. They may be only manners and habits, but they are facts. It is, I submit, fairly obvious to anyone who has ever looked that people are either readers or listeners, excepting only the very small group who get their information through talking and by watching with a form of psychic radar the reactions of the people they talk to. Both President Franklin Roosevelt and President Lyndon Johnson belong in this category, as apparently did Winston Churchill. People who are both readers and listeners, trial lawyers have to be both as a rule, are exceptions. It's generally a waste of time to talk to a reader. He only listens after he's read. It's equally a waste of time to submit a voluminous report to a listener. He can only grasp what it's all about through the spoken word. Some people need to have things summed up for them in one page. President Eisenhower needed this to be able to act. Others need to be able to follow the thought processes of the man who makes the recommendation and therefore require a big report before anything becomes meaningful to them. Some superiors want to see 60 pages of figures on everything. Some want to be in at the early stages so that they can prepare themselves for the eventual decision. Others don't want even to hear about the matter until it's ripe, and so on. The adaptation needed to think through the strengths of the boss and to try to make them productive always affects the how rather than the what. It concerns the order in which different areas, all of them relevant, are presented rather than what's important or right. If the superior's strength lies in his political ability in a job in which political ability is truly relevant, then one presents to him first the political aspect of a situation. This enables him to grasp what the issue is all about and to put his strength effectively behind a new policy. All of us are quote-unquote experts on other people and see them much more clearly than they see themselves. To make the boss effective is therefore usually fairly easy, but it requires focus on his strengths and on what he can do. It requires building on strength to make weaknesses irrelevant. Few things make an executive as effective as building on the strengths of his superior. Making yourself effective. Effective executives lead from strength in their own work. They make productive what they can do. Most executives I know in government, in the hospital, in a business, know all the things they can't do. They are only too conscious of what the boss won't let them do, of what company policy won't let them do, of what the government won't let them do. As a result, they waste their time and their strengths complaining about the things they can't do anything about. Effective executives are, of course, also concerned with limitations, but it's amazing how many things they find that can be done and are worthwhile doing. While the others complain about their inability to do anything, the effective executives go ahead and do. As a result, the limitations that weigh so heavily on their brethren often melt away. Everyone in the management of one of the major railroads knew that the government wouldn't let the company do anything, but then a new financial vice president came in who hadn't yet learned that lesson. Instead, he went to Washington, called on the Interstate Commerce Commission, and asked for permission to do a few rather radical things. Most of these things, the commissioner said, are none of our concern to begin with. The others you have to try and test out, and then we'll be glad to give you the go-ahead. The assertion that somebody else will not let me do anything should always be suspected as a cover-up for inertia, But even where the situation does set limitations, and everyone lives and works within rather stringent limitations, there are usually important, meaningful, pertinent things that can be done. The effective executive looks for them. If he starts out with the question, "What can I do?" he's almost certain to find that he can actually do much more than he has time and resources for. Making strengths productive is equally important in respect to one's own abilities and work habits. It's not very difficult to know how we achieve results. By the time one has reached adulthood, one has a pretty good idea as to whether one works better in the morning or at night. One usually knows whether one writes best by making a great many drafts fast or by working meticulously on every sentence until it's right. One knows whether one speaks well in public from a prepared text, from notes, without any prop, or not at all. One knows whether one works well as a member of a committee, or better alone, or whether one is altogether unproductive as a committee member. Some people work best if they have a detailed outline in front of them. That is, if they've thought through the job before they started. Others work best with nothing more than a few rough notes. Some work best under pressure. Others work better if they have a good deal of time and can finish the job long before the deadline. Some are readers, others listeners. All this one knows about oneself just as one knows whether one is right-handed or left-handed. These, it will be said, are superficial. This isn't necessarily correct. A good many of these traits and habits mirror fundamentals of a man's personality, such as his perception of the world and of himself in it. But even if superficial, these work habits are a source of effectiveness, and most of them are compatible with any kind of work. The effective executive knows this and acts accordingly. All in all, the effective executive tries to be himself. He doesn't pretend to be someone else. He looks at his own performance and at his own results and tries to discern a pattern. "What are the things," he asks, "that I seem to be able to do with relative ease, while they come rather hard to other people?" One man, for instance, finds it easy to write up the final report, while many others find it a frightening chore. At the same time, however, he finds it rather difficult and unrewarding to think through the report and face up to the hard decisions. He is, in other words, more effective as a staff thinker who organizes and lays out the problems than as the decision maker who takes command responsibility. One can know about oneself that one usually does a good job working alone on a project from start to finish. One can know that one does, as a rule, quite well in negotiations, particularly emotional ones, such as negotiating a union contract. But at the same time, one also knows whether one's predictions what the union will ask for have usually been correct or not. These are not the things most people have in mind when they talk about the strengths or weaknesses of a man. They usually mean knowledge of a discipline or talent in an art, but temperament is also a factor in accomplishment, and a big one. An adult usually knows quite a bit about his own temperament. To be effective, he builds on what he knows he can do and does it the way he has found out he works best. Unlike everything else discussed in this audiobook so far, making strength productive is as much an attitude as it is a practice, but it can be improved with practice. If one disciplines oneself to ask about one's associates, subordinates as well as superiors, "What can this man do?" rather than "What can he not do?" one soon will acquire the attitude of looking for strength and of using strength, and eventually, one will learn to ask this question of oneself. In every area of effectiveness within an organization, one feeds the opportunities and starves the problems. Nowhere is this more important than in respect to people. The effective executive looks upon people, including himself, as an opportunity. He knows that only strength produces results. Weakness only produces headaches, and the absence of weakness produces nothing. He knows, moreover, that the standard of any human group is set by the performance of the leaders, and he, therefore, never allows leadership performance to be based on anything but true strength. In sports, we've long learned that the moment a new record is set, every athlete all over the world acquires a new dimension of accomplishment. For years, no one could run the mile in less than 4 minutes. Suddenly, Roger Bannister broke through the old record, and soon the average sprinters in every athletic club in the world were approaching yesterday's record, while new leaders began to break through the 4-minute barrier. In human affairs, the distance between the leaders and the average is a constant. If leadership performance is high, the average will go up. The effective executive knows that it is easier to raise the performance of one leader than it is to raise the performance of a whole mass. He therefore makes sure that he puts into the leadership position, into the standard setting, the performance-making position, the man who has the strength to do the outstanding, the pace-setting job. This always requires focus on the one strength of a man and dismissal of weaknesses as irrelevant unless they hamper the full deployment of the available strength. The task of an executive isn't to change human beings. Rather, as the Bible tells us in the parable of the talents, the task is to multiply performance capacity of the whole by putting to use whatever strength, whatever health, whatever aspiration there is in individuals. Chapter 5. First things first. If there's any one secret of effectiveness, it's concentration. Effective executives do first things first, and they do one thing at a time. The need to concentrate is grounded both in the nature of the executive job and in the nature of man. Several reasons for this should already be apparent. There are always more important contributions to be made than there is time available to make them. Any analysis of executive contributions comes up with an embarrassing richness of important tasks. Any analysis of executives' time discloses an embarrassing scarcity of time available for the work that really contributes. No matter how well an executive manages his time, the greater part of it will still not be his own. Therefore, there's always a time deficit. The more an executive focuses on upward contribution, the more will he require fairly big continuous chunks of time. The more he switches from being busy to achieving results, the more will he shift to sustained efforts, efforts which require a fairly big quantum of time to bear fruit. Yet to get even that half day or those 2 weeks of really productive time requires self-discipline and an iron determination to say no. Similarly, the more an executive works at making strengths productive, the more will he become conscious of the need to concentrate the human strengths available to him on major opportunities. This is the only way to get results. But concentration is dictated also by the fact that most of us find it hard enough to do well even one thing at a time, let alone two. Mankind is indeed capable of doing an amazingly wide diversity of things. Humanity is a multi-purpose tool. But the way to apply productively mankind's great range is to bring to bear a large number of individual capabilities on one task. It is concentration in which all faculties are focused on one achievement. We rightly consider keeping many balls in the air a circus stunt, yet even the juggler does it only for 10 minutes or so. If he were to try doing it longer, he'd soon drop all the balls. People do, of course, differ. Some do their best work when doing two tasks in parallel at the same time, thus providing a change of pace. This presupposes, however, that they give each of the two tasks the minimum quantum needed to get anything done, but few people, I think, can perform with excellence three major tasks simultaneously. There was Mozart, of course. He could, it seems, work on several compositions at the same time, all of them masterpieces, but he's the only known exception. The other prolific composers of the first rank, Bach, for instance, Handel, or Haydn, or Verdi, composed one work at a time. They didn't begin the next until they'd finished the preceding one, or until they'd stopped work on it for the time being and put it away in the drawer. Executives can hardly assume that they are executive Mozarts. Concentration is necessary precisely because the executive faces so many tasks clamoring to be done. For doing one thing at a time means doing it fast. The more one can concentrate time, effort, and resources, the greater the number and diversity of tasks one can actually perform. No chief executive of any business I've ever known accomplished as much as the recently retired head of a pharmaceutical firm. When he took over, the company was small and operated in one country only. When he retired 11 years later, the company had become a worldwide leader. This man worked for the first years exclusively on research direction, research program, and research personnel. The organization had never been a leader in research and had usually been tardy even as a follower. The new chief executive wasn't a scientist, but he realized that the company had to stop doing 5 years later what the leaders had pioneered 5 years before. It had to decide on its own direction. As a result, it moved within 5 years into a leadership position in two new important fields. The chief executive then turned to building an international company, years after the leaders, such as the old Swiss pharmaceutical houses, had established themselves as leaders all over the world. Carefully analyzing drug consumption, he concluded that health insurance and government health services act as the main stimuli to drug demand. By timing his entry into a new country to coincide with a major expansion of its health services, he managed to start big in countries where his company had never been before and without having to take away markets from the well-entrenched international drug firms. The last 5 years of his tenure, he concentrated on working out the strategy appropriate to the nature of modern healthcare, which is fast becoming a public utility, in which public bodies such as governments, nonprofit hospitals, and semi-public agencies such as Blue Cross in the United States pay the bills, although an individual, the physician, decides on the actual purchase. Whether his strategy will work out, it's too early to say. It was only perfected in 1965, shortly before he retired, but his is the only one of the major drug companies that, to my knowledge, has even thought about strategy, pricing, marketing, and the relationships of the industry worldwide. It's unusual for any one chief executive to do one task of such magnitude during his entire tenure, yet this man did three, in addition to building a strong, well-staffed, worldwide organization. He did this by single-minded concentration on one task at a time. This is the quote-unquote secret of those people who do so many things, and apparently so many difficult things. They do only one at a time. As a result, they need much less time in the end than the rest of us. The people who get nothing done often work a great deal harder. In the first place, they underestimate the time for any one task. They always expect that everything will go right, yet, as every executive knows, nothing ever goes right. The unexpected always happens. The unexpected is indeed the only thing one can confidently expect, and almost never is it a pleasant surprise. Effective executives therefore allow a fair margin of time beyond what's actually needed. In the second place, the typical, that is, the more or less ineffectual, executive, tries to hurry, and that only puts him further behind. Effective executives don't race. They set an easy pace, but keep going steadily. Finally, the typical executive tries to do several things at once, therefore he never has the minimum time quantum for any of the tasks in his program. If any one of them runs into trouble, his entire program collapses. Effective executives know that they have to get many things done, and done effectively. Therefore, they concentrate their own time and energy, as well as that of their organization, on doing one thing at a time, and on doing first things first. Sloughing off yesterday. The first rule for the concentration of executive efforts is to slough off the past that has ceased to be productive. Effective executives periodically review their work programs and those of their associates and ask, if we didn't already do this, would we go into it now? And unless the answer is an unconditional yes, they drop the activity or curtail it sharply. At the least, they make sure that no more resources are being invested in the no longer productive past, and those first-class resources, especially those scarce resources of human strength which are engaged in these tasks of yesterday, are immediately pulled out and put to work on the opportunities of tomorrow. Executives, whether they like it or not, are forever bailing out the past. This is inevitable. Today is always the result of actions and decisions taken yesterday. Man, however, whatever his title or rank, can't foresee the future. Yesterday's actions and decisions, no matter how courageous or wise they may have been, inevitably become today's problems, crises, and stupidities. Yet it's the executive's specific job, whether he works in government, in a business, or in any other institution, to commit today's resources to the future. This means that every executive forever has to spend time, energy, and ingenuity on patching up or bailing out the actions and decisions of yesterday, whether his own or those of his predecessors. In fact, this always takes up more hours of his day than any other task. But one can at least try to limit one's servitude to the past by cutting out those inherited activities and tasks that have ceased to promise results. No one has much difficulty getting rid of the total failures. They liquidate themselves. Yesterday's successes, however, always linger on long beyond their productive life. Even more dangerous are the activities which should do well and which, for some reason or other, don't produce. These tend to become, as I've explained elsewhere, investments in managerial ego and sacred. Yet unless they're pruned and pruned ruthlessly, they drain the lifeblood from an organization. It's always the most capable people who are wasted in the futile attempt to obtain for the investment in managerial ego the quote-unquote success it deserves. Every organization is highly susceptible to these twin diseases, but they're particularly prevalent in government. Government programs and activities age just as fast as the programs and activities of other institutions, yet they're not only conceived as eternal, They're also welded into the structure through civil service rules and immediately become vested interests with their own spokesman in the legislature. This wasn't too dangerous when government was small and played a minor role in social life, as it did up until 1914. Today's government, however, can't afford the diversion of its energies and resources into yesterday. Yet at a guess, at least half the bureaus and agencies of the federal government of the United States either regulate what no